back with the money just oozing out of his pockets. It's an exaggeration, of course, because that spring he came back with $1,200 of the $5,000 he was going to raise. Mm-hmm. But then, on a second thought, he decided that Little Sturgeon was not a place to build a seminary. It was not a center of transportation, for one thing. It was out of the way place. Even the main highway bypassed it going to Green Bay. So this is where I found his trace for the first time. In 1887, in April, he came to Sturgeon Bay. He had one of his parishioners had given him a horse, and another one had given him a buggy. So he had transportation. And he came across, the bridge had just been built across the bay then. And he came driving across the bridge. Now Sturgeon Bay was almost predominantly a German community in those days. The power structure of the community was more or less German in character, and all the Germans were Catholics, strong Catholics. Father Vallat, who had been excommunicated already by the Green Bay Diocese, by the bishop, came to Sturgeon Bay, and the bishop, knowing he was coming, had warned the faithful in Sturgeon Bay of the snake in the grass that was coming to visit them. This is a measure of Vallat. He sold the businessmen in the city council, which was largely Catholic and German, on making Sturgeon Bay the religious center for the old Catholic faith in the United States.
That's incredible.
It really is, to the extent that the businessmen of the community, and I had a list of the contributors, and two-thirds of them were Catholics, took up a contribution to purchase, and formed an organization to purchase a site for him. He was going to build, first of all, a seminary, then a cathedral, and a bishop's palace. And this was to be the religious center. Now you see the character of the man. He not only could dream, but he could convince other people of the reality. And not just these offbeat characters, but hard-headed businessmen, tough Germans who wouldn't organize a village because it cost too much in the way of taxes. And they took up a contribution to buy him a site. And every once in a while he'd needle them that it would be much easier to get a better site in a larger community. And there were other communities that apparently he had stimulated to the extent that they were making offers to him. He named several of them. I've never been able to validate the claims, but apparently there was something to it. But anyway, the Businessmen's Association buys a site. Father Vallat picked it out. It was, you know the community?
I know where, I think the park that you're referring to.
You've been up north, and you pass the highway there?
Yeah.
There's a whole area on top of the hill, useless for any other purpose, but dominating the community, the sort of site that people liked to build a church back in the old days. And here the seminary and the cathedral and the bishop's palace were to be built. Well, and in the meantime, Father Vallat had brought in a French priest from New York, Father Beaumont, de Beaumont, who was going to act as his assistant. And Father de Beaumont was left in the community. And by motion of Arnold Wagner, who was a German Catholic, the city voted to turn over one of their old school buildings. It was located on the school yard to Father Vallat to be used temporarily as a chapel and a school until they could get the seminary up. By August, The lot was asking for bids on the seminary, and the Sturgeon Bay Lumber Company was a low bidder, and they received the contract. And they were supposed to go to work that fall building it, and in the meantime, Father Vallot left for the east to raise some more shekels. And then his first stroke of misfortune hit. The Sturgeon Bay Lumber Company went bankrupt and were not able to go ahead with construction. The owners were the Charnley brothers of Chicago. And the older of the brothers, who was a Presbyterian, had decided to corner the grain market down in Chicago. And he'd used all his funds and the company's funds, and the funds that he was trustee for the Presbyterian Church, for the operation of their parochial schools in the United States, used all the funds in order to try to corner the grain market. He didn't. Mm-hmm. The Presbyterian Church almost didn't have any schools for a year, and Sturgeon Bay had a financial crisis for a little while. So the seminary construction was not started. And when, in 1880, in the spring, when Father Vallot got back to Little Sturgeon, rumors started flying. The businessmen received a letter from Father Vallot saying that because of the ill feeling in the community and the fact that Father Beaumont had been persecuted, he had, the school kids had been making faces at him and that sort of thing, it was decided not to locate the seminary here. But at such time, if the antagonism of the community could be abated, this might be considered. Well, the investigation was ordered, and the community was ready to apologize and all that sort of thing, and nothing could be discovered. The real reason for Vallot's sudden lack of desire to build was the fact that he'd run into a roadblock. Bishop Brown was very ill. He was to die in another month. And his subordinates, the people that were going to take over, who were concerned with the church and who were actually carrying on the operation of the church during this period, were beginning to realize that they had created Frankenstein. That Father Vallot's dedication was not to the Episcopal Church. You see, the idea had been that he was going to go down there, convert these people to old Catholicism, and then they would be consolidated with the Episcopal Church. And there was no indication that this was going to happen. Father Vallot, as a old Catholic priest, was only concerned about the expansion of old Catholicism in the United States. And he was providing the basis for that. So the word came down that he must stop. There would be no seminary. Mm-hmm. And then Bishop Brown died, and Bishop Grafton took over. And Grafton was an entirely different person. The Episcopalians tell me he was much more like Vallot.
Only of a different faith, right? So that's why they were so opposed?
It wasn't so much that. It was a clash of personalities.
Oh.
Two big men that couldn't tolerate subordination to the other. And all this under the guise of a professed Christianity that wouldn't recognize the fact that this was a personality clash much more than it was a religious clash. Because Grafton was one of the leaders in the movement to bring the Episcopalians back to the Catholic Church. In fact, he was constantly being accused of undermining the Episcopalian Church in favor of the Roman Catholic Church. And he tried to establish monasteries, much in the Catholic order, even in this area. And it just simply outraged. Grafton was one of these people I found a story of one of his appearances in the cathedral at Fond du Lac. It's very interesting. He came with a sermon that he spent a great deal of time in preparation of, and for some reason or other, very few members of the congregation showed up to hear him. And he became so indignant that he denounced them, tore up the sermon, and stalked out of the church. Well, you can imagine a man like this coming in contact with a man with the visions and the dreams of a Lot. It didn't work. As soon as Grafton made a visit almost immediately to Little Sturgeon. By this time, the Lot had established several churches, one at Walhain, one at Duval. The Lot now, he applied, you see, his problem was this. If the old Catholic Church is to continue in the United States, you must have somebody who can ordain priests. And you have to be a bishop in the apostolic tradition to do that. Now, he asked the Episcopal Church to make him a bishop. But, you see, I think that even today, many of the Episcopalian clergymen are ordained by Roman Catholic bishops. Simply because in many cases the Episcopalian bishop is not in the apostolic succession, and consequently there's always a question about his right to ordain. But the Episcopalian Church would not permit Vallat to become a priest or bishop. So Vallat looked around the world for. In the meantime, in his quarrels with Grafton, he had come under the guardianship of the Greek Orthodox Bishop Vladimir of Alaska. Grafton, sometime in 1891, I'd have to check this, but sometime around in there, went to California and at San Francisco visited Vladimir. And Vladimir took him under his official protection, issued a letter to the Episcopalians and the Roman Catholics saying that Vlat was under his protection and he was not to be persecuted.
Was Vladimir an old Catholic or a Episcopalian?
A Greek Orthodox Catholic.
Greek Orthodox. Now that's different from Roman Catholic.
And of course, traditionally, he would be concerned about trying to cut the feet under the Roman out under the Roman Catholic Church, because there's always been an argument as to which came first, the Roman Catholic Church or the Greek Orthodox Church, because the Greek Orthodox Church was established by Constantine, who removed the capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople from Rome. And so the Roman Empire was located in what is now Turkey, and the eastern branch of the church became entirely different from the western branch of the church, and that's the reason the word Orthodox is involved in there, because the Roman Catholic Church is not supposed to be the Orthodox Christian Church. But anyway, over in Ceylon, the Lot found a bishop who had been consecrated by the Bishop of Antioch, who was, while he was a schismatic bishop, was nevertheless in the apostolic tradition. In other words, he had been ordained by another bishop in the apostolic tradition. So Bishop or Balat raised $120 in Duval and went over to Ceylon. And in May of 1922, he was consecrated there. After a long correspondence that lasted almost half a year, of the various ecclesiastical organizations trying to make it appear as though he weren't competent to receive that office. And he returned to Dykesville in August of 1892, after having visited St. Laurent up in the old school that he had graduated from. Now as a bishop, he came back really as an archbishop, because he was appointed head of the Roman old Catholic Church in the United States. And but about this time, the Episcopalians excommunicated him, because I have some very interesting, there are some, if you check through the files of the Green Bay Press Gazette of the period, you'll find
from the period that Balat was around, like around the 1880s.
I think I have one of them here. November 11th, 1890, Green Bay Daily State Gazette. The old Catholics explain an explanation published by Bishop Grafton. Well, if you will, you go through it, you'll find a number of both sides, the Episcopalians and the Catholics, and the Lot and his group have lengthy communications describing all the reasons why, differences in ritual and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It was at this time that the Episcopalians tried to drive Balat out, and their principal henchman in the attempt was one of Balat's old friends and comrades, Father Gautier, G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R. I don't know how you pronounce it. There's a French and a Belgian way of doing it.
I've heard it pronounced Gautier.
Gautier. The Belgians, more of an accent on the last syllable. He was a man reputed to have supernatural powers, be able to put hexes on people and that sort of thing. And he had gone to school in Laurent with Balat. And he was teaching some place in Wisconsin at the time. Balat started this mission to Little Sturgeon, and Balat asked him to come over, and he took charge of the Church of the Precious Blood. He'd been sent over to Switzerland and made a old Catholic priest, and he took charge of the Church of the Precious Blood while Balat was gallivanting around the country. And he remained loyal, however, to the Episcopalian Church. In fact, he died as an Episcopalian. And he always had a very high opinion of Balat as an individual. But he took the orders of the Church priority over his own personal relationship. The situation at the Church of the Precious Blood was a little bit different from the situation in the other churches that Balat had established in the area, in Duval and Walhain. There, and it would have been the case here also, if he had established a seminary in Sturgeon Bay, the because the deed of the land would have been to Father Vallott and Bishop Brown. But in the case of the Church of the Precious Blood, the deed was made of the ground was made by an Episcopalian woman who lived out east and who had purchased the land and turned it over to the Episcopalian Church.
And the deed was never transferred, or
the deed was in the to the Episcopalian Church.
Okay.
At least that yes, that is true. I remember. I have a copy of the deed. But in the church at Dykesville, there was a question as to just exactly whom it was transferred. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Duval, the church, the property was to Father Vallott. Mm-hmm. So he was very easily driven out of Little Sturgeon, and he went to Dykesville then. And he was driven out of Dykesville also, but there only because he didn't have the money to go to law about the situation. There's a note that the attorney for the Episcopalians writes to Bishop Grafton saying it's very fortunate that Vallott didn't have the money to fight this case, because he said there's a good possibility we wouldn't have been able to win. But he was driven out of Dykesville, and his cathedral was situated in Wall Lane. And then he moved into Green Bay. He had, I think he had two locations there. Oh yeah, at Duval, the title was held by the Episcopalians for the old Catholics.
Mm.
That was it.
Mm.
Let's see. Yes, he moved into Green Bay. What was the name of the church? The I don't have that down there. But the church continued in Green Bay until I think it was down in the 1890s. I found well, you can discover all that yourself. In Green Bay, he created a real crisis, because he was a very colorful character. And it is said that he would even wear his robes of his bishop robes and his regalia when he went down shopping. And I think he did this deliberately to upset the bishop, because yeah. Bishop Mesmer almost lost his head. Vallott was a very hard man to deal with. When they would have processionals or something like that, Vallott would appear in his robes and bless them also. He was very friendly about these matters. But his big successes were in the large cities, Detroit and Chicago. The Poles were coming over at this time in large numbers, and they found that the Catholic Church in the United States was dominated entirely by the Irish. And this was a little bit too much for them, because a Pole couldn't rise up in the hierarchy at all. The Irish controlled everything. So in the large cities where you had large Polish settlements, there was a feeling that the Catholic Church really should be more national in character. Mm-hmm. And there should be a Polish Catholic Church to offset the Italian and the Irish Catholic churches. And Vallott was a key figure in this attempt, because he was about the only available bishop in the apostolic tradition who could consecrate clergymen and open up these new churches. So he was in demand to open up churches, these independent churches in Detroit and in Chicago. But finally, he was even driven out of Green Bay, and this was because of the coming of Pennies and the Norbertines. When was that? Oh yes, in 1893, Father Pennings, and it was in 1894 that Vallott was in Cleveland, dedicating for the Polish Catholics of Cleveland a new church. And prior to that, he'd been in Detroit. But the thing is, at this time, Father Vallott was not able to receive any support from the old Catholics in Europe because of the pressure that the Episcopalians had put on them from this side. And he had gone to Europe. He went to Europe, traveled around in England and the various places, trying to create sympathy and occasioning consternation in all of the countries as he went through. He finally came back, and in March of 1898 he consecrated Stefan Kaminski as Polish bishop in Buffalo after the old Catholics had refused to do so. During this time he published a monthly, an old Catholic monthly, and I've never been able to find copies of it.
I'm wondering where he was getting all the money from to travel around, as he was apparently homeless in this area because he'd been kicked out of every place that he had ever been a pastor.
It's remarkable. But the thing is, he did succeed, despite all his troubles. In Paris, all his regalia was seized because of debts, mm-hmm. his robes and everything. But he did succeed in establishing an old Catholic church of the United States that's still in existence. And there is a church down in Chicago. Now, I heard this from an Episcopalian clergyman who was specializing in fractional Episcopalianism. And he had some of the most weird characters that were turning up. And among them was Vallott, of course. One of his more interesting stories is about a place he visited in New York. Branch of the Episcopalian movement there, in which someone had become the archbishop of the new movement, and he'd gone in to meet the archbishop at a particular address, and he'd gone into a barber shop. And the barber asked him what he wanted, and he told him, and the barber disappeared behind some curtains, and about 5 minutes later he said that he could meet the bishop, and he went in. Here was a barber all arrayed in bishop's robe sitting on the throne. But in Chicago he had a little book which was a history of this organization in Chicago. It had been established, it was among the Negro community, it had been established by Vallott. And it was an old Catholic group, And this book had pictures of a lot in it, in his robes and his letter of creating the church and that sort of thing. And regularly, as part of their liturgy, every day when Mass is celebrated, there's a liturgy that has to deal with a prayer for the lot and for the establishment of the church. Well, anyway, Vallat was excommunicated several times by the Catholic Church, but finally, in 1925, or rather 1926, he was reconciled and absolved by the Catholic Church, and received again into the Church. And the Pope was only too happy, because this resolved something that was fast becoming a festering wound in the Church. He was given residence in a monastery just outside of Paris, Cluny, I believe. He was given a room. But one thing he insisted on was the recognition of his position as bishop. Now, the Vatican law authorities notified the Pope that this was quite proper, that it could be done without any violation of the laws of the Church, because he had been created bishop by a bishop in the apostolic tradition, and that therefore he was legally acceptable by the Church, and this could be done. But for some reason, the Pope refused to do it. And at the age of 75, I think it was, in 1929, Bishop Vallat then put up a little altar in his monastery room and began preaching again and dedicating priests. And this, of course, could have had some terrible consequences, but fortunately, he died of a heart attack in July of 1929. And unfortunately, the young man that was associated with him in his activities got all his documents and hiked off with them, so that there's nothing left of that. But I think that the fascinating thing for this story has been, for me, has been the fact that here was a man